Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at Wisconsin's night sky in these dog days of summer with Jim Lattice. Jim's Associate Professor of Astronomy at UW-Madison, Director of the UW Space Place. Tom Hall back again as well. Tom's an optics specialist with Eagle Optics in Middleton. So we can talk about space and we can talk about how to use those optics to see better in the space as we visit with them. You can join in with questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you could also email us or send us a note on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And maybe you've got a photo or something that you've taken of the space that you want to share with us. You can do that as well by going to The Larry Mueller Show. Jim Lattice, great to see you again.
Great to see you, Larry.
Tom Hall, thank you so much for coming by as well. Appreciate it very much.
Always fun to be here, Larry.
We're in the dog days of summer, so what does that mean, or does that mean something astronomically?
Yeah, it does, as a matter of fact. I remember first learning the term and figuring it just reflected the dogs laying around. I grew up in Kentucky, and you'd see them just laying around looking like they were going to die or something. But no, it's the dog stars, actually. A lot of people know Sirius, the dog star, which we see typically in the evening in the winter. And there's actually another dog star. There's a second dog constellation. There's Canis Major, where the great dog, where Sirius is, and then Canis Minor also contains a prominent star called Procyon. And we both see them in the winter skies in the evening. But the dog days of summer gets the name because this is the time of year, basically during the month of August, when if you're looking at the sky early in the morning before dawn, then the stars that you see emerging, there's kind of a back and forth. The stars are rising on the horizon over there, but the sky is also getting brighter as the sun approaches the horizon. And so when you see a couple of bright stars just before dawn emerging in the twilight, but then they're lost again as the sun comes up, that's called heliacal rising of a star, when it's just before sunrise. And then we can also have heliacal setting, a bright star that's visible just after sunset, but then it disappears. It gets too low on the horizon before the sky gets dark. So this turns out to be the time of year when the dog stars are at heliacal rising. So if you're keeping an eye on what's happening early in the morning during August, you see the dog stars appear, and they're quite prominent by the end of the month. Two really bright stars over there in the pre-dawn sky. So that's the dog days. It's signaled by the dog stars over there, right?
What about the summer Milky Way? Anything going on there that we?
Well, it's a really good time to be looking at the Milky Way, because right about now in the evening sky is when it's highest overhead. And so if you're in a location where you can see the Milky Way at all, which is tricky for a lot of people, if you live in an urban area or the perimeter of an urban area, it's really hard to see the Milky Way. You have to get out into a dark sky. But if you do, in the middle of the evening, 10, 11 o'clock, the Milky Way is arcing high overhead. I like to point out, we often look at the three bright stars that we call the summer triangle. And the Milky Way runs, this time of year, runs almost north to south right through the summer triangle. So even if you're not in a dark sky, that will be a guide as to where the Milky Way would be. And if you are in a dark sky, and occasionally people who aren't familiar with the sky will confuse the Milky Way with some kind of cloudiness or something along that line. If that cloudiness is running north and south through the summer triangle overhead, then you're looking at the Milky Way. And the thickest part of the Milky Way is due south these days, these evenings. So it's really good.
Tom, are there some optics, or what's a good way to look at, other than with the naked eye, to look at the Milky Way or some of these other stars?
Well, I still like binocular observation in the summer skies. It's a little muggier out. It's not quite as clear, perhaps, as you might get in the fall or in good, crisp winter evenings, depending on if, you know, the humidity drops and you can catch that good evening. But binocular observation with a nice lawn chair is always excellent fun. And besides, we have the meteor showers. Not such a great year for particular ones this year, perhaps, because the moon is going to be up. But binoculars are always great for meteor shower observation. There's some excellent new 10x50 binoculars that they've come up with these days that have a super wide field of view. I think it's 100-degree.
How do they do that?
Field of view. Huge prisms. Wow. It's a standard Poral prism-style binocular, just with gigantic prism blocks in them. They're not super expensive either. I think they're under $140 or $150.
You make those?
It's from Vixen Optics. Oh. So those are something to look for new equipment for astronomers. They're only 10 power. That's barely hand-holdable. But a 10x50, so they still deliver a nice big, crisp exit pupil for astronomical viewing. And
boy, one of my favorite astronomical experiences when I was young was with a pair of binoculars on a, it was just kind of luck, but on a nice, clear, dark night, and a pair of binoculars in a lawn chair and gazing into the southern Milky Way. And I was just, it was jaw-dropping what I was seeing out there. I had at that point no idea what I was looking at, but I realized now there are these fantastic star clusters and dust lanes out there that really make for, even if you don't have any idea what you're looking at or looking for, just sort of browsing, so to speak, with a nice pair of binoculars in the summer Milky Way is a great experience.
It was much the same with me. I attended the Nebraska Star Party about 7 or 8 years ago. Tremendously dark skies because they're at 3,000 feet out in the middle of nowhere in northern Nebraska. And I sat around with a 10x50 pair of binoculars and a 12x50 that I wanted to experiment with, and boy, we spent hours at it. It was so bright. There you couldn't mistake the Milky Way because we were standing on some sandy beach at the lake that they had there, and you could see your shadow just from the light of the Milky Way.
Was that bright. Man.
So get those binoculars and take a rest with them, and don't worry about lugging a bunch of equipment. It's a great way to look at the sky.
Oh, it sounds great. What about Saturn? Can we still see Saturn?
Yeah, just barely. If you get out early, it's setting quite early these days, so you'd really be pretty hard pressed to catch Saturn. It's going down. You'll see it in the, just after sunset in the west, low in the west. It looks like the brightest star low in the west. Arcturus is still higher in the west these days, right after sunset. So if you get right out and if you have a low western horizon, then you can probably still get a look at Saturn with your telescope, but it's going to take some careful timing. You have to get out there right away because it sets pretty early. But but it is still worth doing if you can catch some clear sky because the rings were earlier this year, late last year, the rings were almost edge-on, which is an interesting sort of view,
right?
But not what most people expect from Saturn. And there are reasons why having the edge-on view is really useful. We look for that to look for the moons more prominently and things like that. But what people like to see are the rings, and the rings are tipping back now to full the widest angle that we tend to get. So now is a good time. And other than that, as soon as the sun catches up with Saturn and then passes it, and if in a couple of months we'll have Saturn rising over in the dawn sky, and you'll have to get up before dawn to catch it. It'll still be just as great, but it's a lot less likely for people to fit it into their schedules.
And didn't we send off a ship to take a closer look at Saturn? Or am I just dreaming this up?
No, the Cassini spacecraft is still operational out there. Last I heard, and that's been since 2006 or so.
Yeah.
And continues to send back really interesting stuff from Saturn, which is the whole Saturn system is a really complex system out there. So they'll never run out of things to look at as long as Cassini keeps on working and as long as we can keep on operating it from the ground. These things tend to sometimes go in the direction of budget impacts. It costs a lot to keep a control center and people involved here on the ground. But as long as we keep running it, it should be
Should be fine.
Should be good, yeah. That was the one that dropped a probe onto Titan, to the largest moon of Saturn, which is, like a planet. It's got an atmosphere and oceans, a whole weather system of liquid methane going up there. So it's really cool.
Jim Lattice and Tom Hall, our guests, as we talk about Wisconsin skies, night skies, and the dog days of summer. Lots of callers starting to join us. If you'd like to join in, call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Mike in Sheboygan. Mike, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. This is a great show. Hey, one of the great moments of fatherhood I've had was when my son was young, and about 1 o'clock in the morning, looking at the northern lights, getting in the truck and taking rural roads and explaining to my son, who was maybe six at the time, about, you know, what the northern lights were. And the way I explained it was, it was kind of like the Earth's force field, in some way buckling and shimmering and essentially protecting the Earth and normally being invisible, but then just having something so dramatic above you, something that's normally invisible. And I wish more people kind of got word in advance. I used to go to the space weather site every day, and that's about the only way I would know in advance to be on the lookout. And I was just wondering if your guests could comment on, you know, my hope that maybe local reporting would take up space weather phenomenon in advance, so that people, I mean, seems like when the northern lights are here and you can see them, it seems like everybody in every community would want to be outside.
Yeah. Well, there are ways actually to do that.
Right. Well, space weather is certainly the first thing I would have tossed out. But there are certainly plenty of places on the web to check into solar activity. I think space weather is specifically designed to warn you of things like that. So that's probably the single best place. I can't speak for the media. But it's also been fairly quiet for the last few years too. And so if there's an uptick as we expect in solar activity, then we may see more northern lights in the near future.
But you can get those, they'll email you an alert.
That's right. You can sign up for email alerts, and there's even I haven't done it myself, but there's some kind of a phone alert system. I believe you have to pay for that, but they seem to advertise there on Space Weather, so I'm sure you can find their ad there. And yeah, your phone will actually ring at 2 a.m. and let you know that you know there's something going on. But you're certainly right about the Northern Lights being a wonderful sight. Or, I mean, if you're in the southern hemisphere, the southern, although it's easier in the north because we have so much more land close to the poles. What you're really seeing, it's the Earth's magnetic field. And the Earth's magnetic field as clouds of high-energy particles come from the sun. So when there's something called a coronal mass ejection, which is basically an eruption of material away from the sun, if the Earth happens to be in the way of one of those, then those high-energy particles are sort of trapped by the Earth's magnetic field and funneled into the Earth's atmosphere, and they funnels in toward the poles, the north and the south poles. And when those high-energy particles, mostly electrons, end up pummeling the molecules of the Earth's atmosphere, they hit, say, an oxygen atom or something along that line and energize it, and then that energy gets emitted as light. So it's a little bit like a fluorescent light bulb works in a similar sort of way, converting electricity into light. The northern lights are doing the same thing, converting high-energy particles from the sun into glowing atmospheric gases, and we see those glowing gases rippling overhead in the ionosphere, and the different colors come from different energy levels and different molecules being relaxing into radiation.
Tom Hall of Eagle Optics, Jim Lattice of the UW Space Place, our guests. If you'd like to join in, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller, Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking our stars in the night sky today with Jim Lattice and Tom Hall. Great to have you listening in. John in Jefferson has a question for you guys, or a comment. John, let's go to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was camping up at Rocket Cree, which is just north of Friendship, the weekend of the 31st, and they have a very nice prairie that we took the telescope out onto and had a very clear night. Looked at the Big Dipper, looked at the North Star, and then swung over to Cassiopeia in the Milky Way itself. And I was just amazed about how many stars I could get inside my little 125 telescope that you could actually lose count. But in the middle of this, with some friends of mine, they were kind of looking at stars and this and that. We saw a very large shooting star, went from full white, and then actually at the end you could see it actually turn to red as it broke up in the atmosphere. And it was probably one of the most beautiful things I've seen in a long time.
Well, congratulations. Those are fun to see.
Oh, yes.
Tom, have you ever seen anything like that?
I've seen a few shooting stars, maybe not quite that bright that I can remember describing, but boy, I've seen them from edge on. And I've seen them from the little meadow he's talking about in Rochacree State Park. My boys and I love the camp there. It's just north of Adam's Friendship. As he'd said, there's a terrific climb there, too, that you can go up on the rock face with their wooden stairs there. So great, great state park to go to.
Meteors like that are coming in constantly, really, sort of randomly, except during meteor showers when we know that there are specific increases in the rate. But if you watch the sky long enough, you'll invariably see, in fact, you don't have to watch very long usually to see a couple of shooting stars on a moonless night to see some nice meteors. You wait long enough, and I don't mean real long, hours, days, and you'll see some nice bright meteors as well. So they're great.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. We got an email from Jeff in Madison who says, binoculars get heavy. Here's a great, easy, cheap trick. I pound a 2-foot piece of rebar into the ground about halfway and slip a 10-foot length of 1/2-inch PVC water pipe over it. I have a loop of heavy string on the other end of the pipe, which I loop around the binocular, and the weight of the binoculars is enough to bend the pipe down. Oh, my goodness. Hmm. Sit in your lawn chair, and the pipe takes all of the weight off the binocular to give you a steady view. Now, Tom, have you ever tried that?
I haven't tried that one, but I like the simplicity of what that sounds. I've used binocular mounts that are usually larger parallelograms made out of, you know, two steel bars on one end and another on the other, and they'll have a platform. You try to mount the bino on and counterweight out the other end. And boy, just like Jerry's describing there, this sounds like a nice, simple, something that would run you around $8 in parts that you could try with. I think the trick, like he tries to describe there, is, you know, holding the pipe down on the end or trying to eliminate vibration out of it. But, you know, it sounds like the pipe itself would eliminate some of that just by the bending property and the fact that it's lighter weight kind of whipping over and sitting in front of your observing chair. I'll have to try it now. That sounds interesting.
Sounds like a good kit to keep in the car, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, that kind of thing would work really well. Those parallelogram mounts that Tom mentioned are really nice. They're much more sophisticated hardware. They do have the nice property that you can point them and then let them go, and then somebody else, and they'll stay steady. Kids, for example, you can point it at something and then say, okay, here, look in here. Whereas this, you would have to, of course, be holding yourself the whole time. But still, that is a big issue, that fatigue of holding the binoculars. That's a good idea.
Steve in Richfield, we turn to you now. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I was wondering if anybody tried to explain why substances collect in large amounts in the solar system. Like earlier in the show, you mentioned there's a planet that has a large amount of methane, and this would go against entropy.
It would?
Well, doesn't entropy say that everything tends to disorder? And if you're collecting, say, methane together in large amounts, or the gas giants, there's a lot of gas, whatever the gas is, that would be tending towards order.
Well, you can only invoke entropy if you're talking about a closed system. And when you're talking about, say, a planet, let's suppose that you take a disordered mixture of stuff and let it collapse under gravity into a planet. And so you've got really dense stuff and you've got really light stuff like methane, and now you let gravity work. There will be a natural tendency for the heavier stuff to sink towards the middle and the lighter stuff to float out to the outside. That's what astronomers call differentiation. But you don't have a closed system there. So it's you would have to identify your closed system first, draw what dotted line you want around there, and say, I'm going to measure the entropy at two different times. But when you're talking about things going on in the solar system, you're never going to find a closed system. So you see local variations in entropy, including in your own refrigerator at home, all the time. But that's not a closed system.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. And let's go to Katie in Appleton next. Hi, Katie.
How are you?
Great. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I was actually wondering what you guys thought about those applications that you can get on your like smartphone or iPod touches that have like stargazing maps in them, and they use like the camera to detect the constellations and planets and such. Like, what you thought about those and how they work?
Sure. Let's. Should we turn to Tom first? Tom Hall.
Yeah, there's a number of those you can look for, and I know we've mentioned some in the show in the past. One in particular called Starwalk that's not particularly expensive, but uses for iPhone uses the GPS system in the phone itself, so it will tell itself where it is and tell you, you know, what's going on in the sky. It will generate maps for you. You can just point it around and use it like that. I think they're terrific. They also have expanded it so that you can use it with the iPad, which will have a much larger screen and be much more useful. But they're not expensive. They're $5 or less, and they're in the App Store. That one in particular is called Star Walk.
Yeah, I actually like to use and recommend one that's actually free called Stellarium. That Stellarium, like planetarium, but Stellarium.
Sure.
And you'll find that if you go, I believe Stellarium.com is the website, and Stellarium is available on the iPhone and works really well. And but you can also download it onto your PC. It will run on Macs and Windows and Linux. And I actually use it a lot at Space Place. I use it for almost all my talks down there, what's going on in the sky. And that's free.
What does it do?
It's basically a computer planetarium sort of program. It will show you the sky as it appears from anywhere on the Earth, any time, any day. And you can see, so you can, if you just turn it on and have it set for Madison, it'll show you what the sky looks like right now. Or you can run it ahead, say, to 10 p.m. It'll show you what the sky looks like at 10 p.m. The ones on the computer are handier because the screen is bigger, but the iPhone is cute because it does, like Tom says, it uses the accelerometers in the phone. So you can tip it up and turn it around, and it'll attempt to show you what you would be in front of, what is in front of you when you're looking at the sky in a certain direction. So if you can use that, I've never quite gotten used to that. That screen's a little small for me, but it will do its best to try to tell you what you're looking at in the sky.
I saw another really interesting adapter that's more of a mechanical piece for use with telescopes, but they now have iPhone adapters out that will grip your iPhone and attach to an 1.25-inch eyepiece. They're from a company called Magnalux. It's in the latest Sky and Telescope magazine. They have a small blurb of it, but it will hold the camera of your iPhone or the, you know, fourth generation iPod touches correctly at an afocal point over an eyepiece. You leave the eyepiece in just like you'd look through the scope, and you can use your camera to take pictures of what you're seeing in the scope or use it as a display to show the kids what you're looking through. And it also means that you can adapt your iPhone for standard camera tripods. You can put it on an 1.25-inch camera tripod. It's made specifically to put onto an eyepiece for a telescope. So you can look for those, too. If you have a buddy who has a telescope, you can... you can be looking at your star maps while you're trying to find out what you're looking at. And then
so you can do astrophotography with the iPhone.
Take a picture of it when you're done finding it.
How cool is
that? Oh, that's great. Thanks for calling, Katie.
Yeah, of course. Thanks so much.
Appreciate it very much. Jerry and Viola would like you to comment on the special star alignment set to happen in 2012.
I'm not sure what alignment that is. I hear a lot about alignments in 2012. But I don't hear too many specifics. The only one that I remember specifically being described as an alignment is the alignment of the summer solstice with the plane of the Milky Way. But that actually happens basically every year. It's not anything special to 2012. So it's true that it will happen in 2012, but it's unlikely that it will have any effects any different than when it happens this year or in 2013 either. So that's the only alignment I remember. The planets are constantly grouping and regrouping out there in the sky, and there's no particularly close grouping during 2012 either. So I guess I'm not really sure what that alignment is, but a lot of the 2012 talk is driven by kind of undefined talk about alignments, and an alignment in a very strict sense is very rare thing, and there aren't any actually strict alignments happening in 2012 that I know of, at least nothing that's unique to that year.
Join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We got open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. Let's go to Deborah in Brown Deer. Hi, Deborah.
Hello. Oh, what a great program, and I'm sorry I missed the beginning of it, but I grew up in Marquette, Michigan, and I used to take my sleeping bag across the street to the beach and watch the northern lights. So, and we had a planetarium, a huge planetarium at our high school. So I feel really, I'm grateful for that. But what I want to say is, here in Brown Deer, about a year and a half ago, I was walking from my neighbor's house down their sidewalk, looking east, and saw the most gigantic, I'm assuming a meteor. It was like bright fluorescent green, like antifreeze, and it lasted probably, I can't even like recall, but it was the longest amount of time, maybe 10 seconds. And I screamed, and my son saw it too. So that I wondered what that was, and I saw recently, just within the past month, something, I wasn't sure what it was. I thought it was some kind of craft at night, and it was probably maybe 1 or 2 in the morning. And looking east again with my telescope, it was my naked eye. It was like, it looked like, then when it was all done, it looked like a meteor, but it was sideways. So is that common, or was it something else?
When you say it was sideways, you mean it was traveling horizontal to the parallel to the horizon?
Correct.
I see.
And it was going from south to north as I looked east into the, well, would be directly over Lake Michigan, even though I can't see Lake Michigan, but it was that direction.
And then that one turned into a meteor? You mean?
No, it just fizzled. Yeah, I thought it was like some kind of like a satellite or something, but it was, I'm like, oh, whoa, what is that? It was so fast. But then I saw it had an itty-bitty tail at the very end, but it was so short. It was like, and it was, I don't know what it was, but it looked like a meteor by the time I had seen it, and this is in the course of 5 seconds, it had ended up having like a tiny tail, but really, like, blink your eyes and you would have missed it. But it was horizontal.
They do go fast. And you say that was about 1 in the morning?
Maybe, you know, what, between 1 and 3.
Yeah, okay. So that's not going to be a satellite. At least it's pretty unlikely. We tend to see satellites within a couple of hours of sunset or sunrise, although I guess you're getting close there. But if it moved really fast like that, then it's almost surely a meteor. The really bright one that you mentioned is probably just a really bright meteor, although occasionally we do see re-entering space junk. And so it's possible that you saw a piece of a re-entering piece of a rocket, something along that line. Those occasionally catch a glimpse of one of those, too. They tend to look just like an ordinary meteor, but sometimes when they're especially bright, that's a possibility.
Well, you mean it could have hit it, when space junk falls, it could hit land. It could land on someone's house, or what happens?
Well, normally not. Most of the space junk is not massive enough to survive the fall, but you might remember quite some years ago, pieces of Skylab landed on Australia intact. Well, not intact, but I mean they survived the fall. Big chunks of it, especially heavy structural pieces. So it's possible for those things, fragments of those, to survive. But for the most part, not. Usually we're talking about something that's like, say, the upper stage of some rocket that has been discarded after boosting something into orbit. And those things are as thin and light as they can make them. And they tend to disintegrate completely on their way in. But you can see them when they come in.
We could have a space junk museum someday.
Thanks a lot for calling. I was saying, as you were talking, Deborah, I was thinking about the meteor that came through Madison. Or
was that last spring? I mean, last year, spring.
Last year, I think we heard it. I mean, it was. I think there was a noise connected with it, and I remember it. Well, people found pieces of it.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah. Right. That was, in fact, last I saw, they have some pieces over at the Geology Museum here on campus, over in Weeks Hall. Quite a few fragments. I'm not sure they even know how many fragments. Definitely there were a lot of fragments found, and a lot of private collectors came in and were looking for them in the days right afterwards. So those pieces collected there might not even be documented yet, but I know there's at least, I don't know, 10 or a dozen pieces. I remember seeing an exhibit at the Geology Museum of a handful, 8 or 10 mm-hmm. pieces that were on loan there. They definitely, that was a really bright one. I think it was that April?
I think it was.
Yeah. And that was,
woke us up.
Those sorts of things are relatively rare, not because they happen rarely, but because it has to happen If it happens in the daytime, nobody will see it. If it happens when it's cloudy, nobody will see it. If it happens between midnight and dawn, not too many people will see it. That one just happened to come through at prime time, so to speak, after dark, but during an hour, I think it was like 10 p.m. or something along that line, when people are still up and walking the dog or looking at the sky and things like that. And so so that one really caught people's notice. But those sorts of things do happen at a fairly constant rate.
Peter in Stoughton has a question for you guys. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. I was wondering if anyone knew if Juno would have any visual sensors aboard. I understand it's going to be doing magnetic studies and radiation studies on Jupiter, and I'm wondering if we're going to get any pretty pictures out of it.
Oh, I'm sure they will. He's talking about the Juno mission going to Jupiter, which
just launched.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. There we go. And that means arrival is sometime, I think I read, in 2016 or 2015, something in that. It's going to take it a few years to get there. But boy, I am quite sure they'll have imaging cameras.
Well, they're definitely imaging in the infrared.
Right.
And so we'll see pretty pictures, even if what we're seeing are what they call scientific colors. They'll take infrared and map those into, you know, normal colors that you can print and see. So we'll certainly see things like that. I'd be surprised if there aren't optical range sensors on there, but I'm not sure about that. The emphasis has been on the infrared because they can use that to probe the atmosphere.
There's a good article for you in the September issue of Sky and Telescope, which I haven't had a chance to read all the way through. So so there's some resource out there for looking at it. But yeah, I think that's the cover story on September's Sky and Telescope for us. And that should be an excellent, interesting mission, at least as good as Cassini for the science they'll pull out of that.
Yeah, and you'll certainly see things on website. I can't tell you a specific website, but I'm sure there's a NASA website devoted to that mission. And then probably on the Sky and Telescope and astronomy websites, there will be articles about it. The thing that's been causing a lot of discussion just lately is they enclosed three little Lego figures on there, representing Jupiter, the Greek god, and Juno, one of his wives, who's along as a Lego figure, and a little Galileo, who of course started Jupiter studies. Really,
oh boy! Do you know if it will be concentrating primarily on Jupiter, or will it be doing flybys of the moons, or do you know what the parameters of the mission are going to be?
I believe it is concentrating on Jupiter. I'm seeing here now that the arrival is July 4th, 2016. Nice date for them to put out for the press releases, no doubt. But I think it's going to concentrate on Jupiter. I would imagine by the time it gets in Jupiter orbit, they might not have much fuel left to move around for lunar work, but they might.
Yeah, they often will do sort of opportunities. I don't know specifically on that. The focus is certainly on the Jovian atmosphere, because part of the idea is to follow up on the Galileo spacecraft quite a few years ago, dropped a probe into the Jovian atmosphere, which produced some somewhat surprising results. It produced some profiles of the atmosphere that people didn't expect, especially in terms of water vapor content. And so Juno is going to follow up on that, not by probing physically the atmosphere, but by using infrared, which can get at various layers in the atmosphere and try to map the water vapor.
And this might be the answer to your question. I'm skimming in the article. It sounds like it's going to be a fairly close orbit, because they say they hope to have it survive 32 orbits.
Thank you.
And then it augers in, is what it sounds like. So there we go.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We had an email from Betsy wondering about the Perseids this year, and this is supposed to be a good year for Perseid meteor showers, right?
Oh, well, I'm afraid not.
No.
No, it's the peak of the Perseids. So the Perseids, a couple of weeks, you'll see Perseid activity. So chances are you can get out there.
Starting now.
Yeah. on a early in the morning, the moon is still setting early. I guess we're just past first quarter or so. So the moon will set and the sky is dark on into the morning hours, and you might well see some Perseids. Unfortunately, by the time of the peak, so a couple of days around the 13th, I think is the peak this year. That's also full moon. And so that means that most of the night you'll have moonlight to contend with. And the problem is, that the vast majority of the Perseids are really dim. And so moonlight is enough to render them almost invisible. So when we have a deep moonless, peak of the Perseids, you see lots and lots of them. But if the moonlight washes out 75% of them or something like that, then you only see the very brightest meteors. So it's certainly possible to see some Perseids, but the actual night of the peak will not be the best time to do it.
Tom Hall, optics specialist with Eagle Optics in Middleton, and Jim Lattice, associate professor of astronomy at UW-Madison, director of the UW Space Place, our guests. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a photograph there. Here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can join in with your questions again as we talk space and the night sky and optics as well with our two guests, Jim Lattice and Tom Hall, at 1-800-642-1234. They're going to be with us until around noon today, as a matter of fact. President Obama is giving a press conference that we think will start at noon. It might sometimes he starts a little early, in which case we'll probably drop out fairly quickly here. But we'll be going with Jim and Tom right up until about 12 o'clock. And, of course, we had Victoria Houston scheduled to be with us to talk about the latest installment in her Loon Lake Fishing Mystery Series and to talk about the craft of writing. But we phoned her, and she agreed to come next Tuesday. So she'll be with us next week, Tuesday, at 11:45, and she will talk with us about her latest book at that time. So we're staying right with the stars and the sky, and Dan in Milwaukee has a question for you guys. So let's go to Dan. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. Thank you for calling.
All right. My question was revolved around, I heard from a friend that there was an article released about a supernova that was going to be detonating sometime soon, and I didn't know if that meant within the next month or within the next couple million years, and if you could answer that, and then what type of supernova it will be.
Well, we can't actually predict when a star is going to become a supernova, so there are several what they call supernova candidates, that is, stars that we think are in the right state to explode as a supernova. But usually that means, you know, sometime, as you say, in the next million years or something along that line. They definitely cannot look at a star and say, oh, that's going, you know, next week this time or something along that line. But I've read a couple of, Betelgeuse in Orion is one that's often discussed as a supernova candidate. So it's possible the article was about one of those, but that would be real broadly speaking that these stars are likely to become supernovas in the future.
And so the definition of a supernova then would be?
Something that happens to very massive stars, much more massive than the sun. So the sun is not a supernova candidate even in the far out future of its evolution. But the very massive stars, as they exhaust their fuel in the core of the star, ultimately that core collapses. And in the case of a very massive star, that collapse is quite sudden and causes a disruption to the rest of the star, basically blows off the outer layers a considerable fraction of the mass of the star. And that releases an enormous amount of energy. So when a supernova occurs, it can become many, many, like hundreds of millions of times as bright as the star itself was. There are plenty of cases where the light of a supernova outshines the light from all the rest of the stars in its galaxy combined. And mostly we see these happen in distant galaxies. So they actually happen fairly frequently in distant galaxies where you can't make out the individual star until it explodes. But we have pretty good data on supernovas because we have a large sample of them from other galaxies. In our galaxy, they're calculated to happen every couple of centuries. But a good bit of our galaxy is shrouded from us by the dust clouds in the plane of the Milky Way. So one could happen on the other side of the galaxy, and we wouldn't see it optically. We might see it by other means, like infrared or something along that line.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Dan. Appreciate it. Susan in Beaver Dam, on to you now. Hi, Susan.
Hello. Hello. About 10 years ago, I saw a light in the sky during the day from one end of the horizon in a perfect half circle to the other end of the horizon, and my grandson was there. He saw a tour. They might have asked me what I'd been drinking. Do you know what that was?
Was it a traveling light, or?
No, it was steady. It was
a steady line of light?
Not moving, you mean? It was not tracking across the sky like a satellite. It was just a steady, bright light?
It was a half circle from one end of the horizon up the sky to the other end of the horizon, and it didn't move.
Well, I don't know. Could you have been seeing part of some kind of a sun halo or something?
Yeah, what time of day was this? Do you remember offhand?
Probably noon, 1 o'clock.
Boy, it sounds like a meteorologist question to me.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a number of phenomena. There are things called sun dogs, and there are solar halos and things like that. None of them, to the extent that I can recollect, quite match your description there.
Right. I've seen the sun halos, but okay. Well, yeah. She said maybe the last Monday of the month, the weather guy might know.
Yes. They're on the last Monday of the month. You can post a call then, and they may have an answer.
And it's always important to have as much information as you can, about that, the time and date and things, as much as you can put together. So that's good that you have some of that.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And John and Rhinelander, on to you. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks for calling.
Good. I was with driving a sag wagon for a group of guys that were bicycling across Iowa the week of the 22nd of July, and we were camping out every night, and I noticed just all sorts of shooting stars. I wonder if there was a meteor shower that week or something happening across Iowa that wasn't happening anywhere else.
It's certainly possible. There are meteor showers pretty frequently during the course of the year. I'm going to flip real quick and see if I can find out whether there's something listed for late.
What were the dates
July.
Of that ride again?
It would have been the 23rd to the 31st.
There is a minor shower there that I do recall because I'd mentioned Nebraska Star Party earlier in the program, and they generally run late July, and I remember a number of meteor showers when we were out there with those dark skies. So I would guess that's it. And Jim's right. You know you don't have to be in the middle of a shower to see a set of meteors over the course of an evening either. You can go out any evening and just hope for the best. So, but no, I think you're correct. That was probably some minor activity that I don't know the name of for that particular shower. But I've noticed some at that time of year also.
It was quite amazing. I mean, it was every. Every minute or two we see a shooting star, and I say that's really
That's cool. They do come in randomly, but it sounds like you were beating the odds there. So and in fact there are a couple of showers, minor showers, active towards the end of July. At least two of which are likely to be in the evening sky. So you could very well have encountered a minor shower. We tend to concentrate on the major ones, but just because we talk about the Perseids and then talk about the Geminids and things like that, there are lots of minor showers that are active here and there during the course of the year.
It was so hot and humid, we thought the heat was getting to us.
Might have been that too.
Thanks, John.
Bye.
Bye. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. CJ wanted to know, and this goes back to your comment about Stellarium, that app, if it's available for Android as well.
The answer is I don't know. It is a multi-platform thing, and if they ported it to the iPhone, I wouldn't be surprised if they hadn't ported it. I don't have an Android phone, so I'm not exactly sure how you go about getting those. I would think a quick Google.
Yeah, well, actually, as a matter of fact, Judith has already posted on our Facebook page a link to Stellarium. So if you just go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and you can click on that, it'll take you right to it.
Yeah, of course, that's the obvious thing. Go to Stellarium.com, and they'll probably talk about whatever versions they have available.
And Jean, a caller, Gene from Milwaukee, wanted to make sure that people know about the observatory in the Harrington Beach State Park near Cedarburg in Lake Church. Their observation schedule is also available online. I think it's ATNCSF dot info. And there are lots of good places for people to get out and see.
Yeah, there's certainly plenty of opportunities for observing the sky. And, of course, we also have various astronomically related events, talks, and that sort of thing, a few that are coming up in the fairly near future. Here, Washburn Observatory on the UW campus, as we always mention, is open every Wednesday night through the summer, weather permitting, obviously, and then the first and third Wednesday nights the rest of the year, as we've been doing for 130 years. So lots of opportunities.
Mary and Madison, we turn to you next. Hi, Mary.
Oh, yes, you're talking on point about the sun, and they were talking about helium and hydrogen in a nebula, those two elements, and a few dust particles. And a nebula was kind of like a nursery for a star, and it needed a nova. And they were talking about where all the other elements came from, like carbon, and they didn't know that. Something like that. I'm not a scientist.
Sure.
Well, so yeah, it sounds like I didn't hear that program, but it must have been generally about star formation and stellar evolution. All the things you've mentioned in there figure into such a discussion. Stars do form in star forming regions that, more generically, you could call a nebula. They form out of clouds of gas, like that's primarily, predominantly hydrogen, and with some helium and less of the rest of the heavier things beyond helium, like carbon and things like that. And these star forming regions typically have a lot of dust particles in them as well. So star formation can be triggered by a nearby supernova. When you have one of these nebulas, something has to trigger the gravitational collapse into a star. And one thing that can do it is a nearby supernova, which creates shock waves that can cause cloud collapse and further star formation. So we often see sort of cascades, avalanches, so to speak, of star formation in these nebulas. And then once a star forms, what it's doing is it's glowing, it's creating energy because the hydrogen out of which it formed deep in its core is fusing into helium and producing energy in the process. And heavier and massive stars, heavier elements are formed as well. Those supernovas that we were talking about earlier, those are stars that have created heavier elements right on up to as heavy as iron inside the star. And when those things blow up, it's like cracking an egg.
Yeah.
And all that heavier stuff gets distributed back into the same nebula that it formed from, depending on just what has happened there. And it enriches the nebula. The sun is a third or fourth generation star. We have so many heavy elements in the sun and in us that all of that material must have come from supernovas that happened long before our solar system formed.
Interesting. Thank you very much, Mary, for calling. Appreciate it. And Andrew in Waukesha, hello to you.
Hi. I have two questions, actually. When I'm standing in an open field, how far away is the horizon? How many miles away am I looking?
It depends on the terrain and things like that. If I'm not mistaken, if you're standing, let's say you're on a boat in the middle of a lake that extends to the horizon, or on the ocean or something along that line. I think the horizon is in the neighborhood of 50 miles away. But if you're on an ocean liner and you're up many feet above the water, then the horizon is farther away. So it depends on your particular circumstances. On a mountaintop, the horizon is very far away.
comment, just basically when I'm out looking at stars. So,
well, again,
probably 15 miles at best. If you're standing on the ground.
If you're standing on the ground, especially if you're on land, because almost always the mathematical horizon is way below whatever, you know, trees and hills, whatever terrain around you, that cuts it off usually more than the geometrical limitations.
All right. And I also have a question about the odd star that's in the western sky last couple of nights. It flashes red and blue in my binoculars.
Well, how hard, what time is this?
About 11 o'clock at night, and it's above the horizon. It's more west than northwest.
My guess would be you're looking at Arcturus, which is getting low enough by that time that you could definitely see what they call scintillation, sparkling, twinkling is the common word for it. Yeah,
yeah, the scientific is not the scientific term, the common.
Yeah, the poetic term.
Oh, boy. Lots of fun. Jim, Tom, thank you both so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure.
You bet, Larry.
Jim Lattice, Faculty Associate of Astronomy at the UW-Madison, Director of the UW Space Place. One of our guests, the other, Tom Hall, Optics Specialist with Eagle Optics in Middleton. We'll be moving now to the press conference with President Obama here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.